My name is Steve Nenninger, and I have the honor of introducing Dr. Diadamo today. I want to thank Peter and Martha for asking me and for this beautiful dinner. I don't need much more than a couple hours of sleep each night anyway, so staying up all night thinking about these, what to say through my head was no problem. I'm a type A, so I don't stress very much, so it was no big deal. No problem. Anytime. So why am I stressed, right? Because I talk a lot. I'd rather talk to 1,000 people than do this, okay? I'm stressed because I really deeply believe, after 20 years of practice and thousands of people I've worked with, that Dr. Diadamo's work is brilliance and a gift to us all. And as I was thinking about this talk and I was lying in bed with my eyes wide open, the word greatness kept coming through my head. Greatness, greatness. You know, and Peter and Martha, I don't want to say Peter's humble, but he gave me a full 2 minutes to do my intro. So I'm probably a minute and 30 seconds into it already. So I've got to wrap it up pretty quickly here because I have a full 2 minutes. But greatness kept coming through my head. I think greatness is what it's about. If you don't want to be a great doctor, you probably wouldn't be here. And even if maybe that's not your priority right here, you probably want to be a great parent. You probably want to be a great friend. You probably want to be a great student. You want to be great. And I couldn't get that thought out of my head. And I realized in my life, what I've chosen to do is surround myself with greatness. That's why I brought my friend and physicist Anthony Beauvais here with me tonight, because I like to surround myself with greatness. And I invited my friend Jeannie, Donnie, who's been working tirelessly for 15 years to get the profession licensed. That's greatness. Dr. Roseanne Nenninger, who just spent 2 weeks in India treating people with homeopathy and to improve herself. That's greatness. That's why I like to be around Dr. Diadamo and his work, is because understanding or trying to understand what he's talking about makes me feel great. I was getting some meat sliced at the lunch counter today, and I was talking with the woman, and I've noticed her for a couple years. She's worked there for a while at Wild by Nature, and I finally asked her, I'm like, what blood type are you? Because she can deal with the people yelling at her on top, the people that work for her or love her. She's like, I'm a B positive. I said, I knew you were B positive. And she's like, you know what I do? She's like, I follow my blood type diet. And that totally changed my health. Like that. That to me is greatness. When you can reach out into the world and project your insights and change people's lives that you never touched or saw or met, that's what I want for myself. That's greatness. And that's why I'm sweating bullets talking about Dr. Diadamo. Now, I'm not going to tell you that I'm going to understand what he's going to talk about tonight. In fact, my friend Curtis said, my friend Curtis, who's actually not a naturopathic doctor but was studying up on the material for tonight, said, I'm hoping to get 1%. Now, he's much smarter than me, so I'm hoping for 0.5%. But you know what? If I can sit here tonight and go home with 0.5% of greatness and bring that back to my patients and give that to them tomorrow, I'll take that. That'll be time well spent. And I'm really looking forward to probably definitely the most well-known, most successful, most published author in naturopathic medicine in the history of our profession, Dr. Peter Diadamo.
Thank you, Steve. Welcome, and thank you for coming. And on behalf of Martha and myself, greetings. It's a pleasure to see so many old friends and to meet so many new people, to see how this little community is is continuing to thrive and what this is all about. Some of you came, hopped on airplanes to be in this room, which is actually kind of intimidating. But what I've done in the past oftentimes is throw a bunch of people in the room, specifically at about the time of this IHS conference, because it tends to bring people together, and sort of organize a happening from like the 50s, a happening with something where something just happened. You know, we found this wonderful place, thanks to Roseanne Neninger, with this killer view. At some point in time, hopefully not during my lecture, you should go out the door and just kind of see the view of St. Patrick's out there. Mind-bogglingly wonderful. And so thank you, Roseanne, for finding this wonderful place. I think it's really done a lot. And again, I think Steve was very generous with his comments. I just don't know how to respond. I think that Steve is actually one of the few people I can honestly say who I went to dinner with and actually paid the tab. And that's such a... I kind of made a mental note of that. So other people I'd like to thank, for instance, Nancy, who's also been critical, Roseanne, to putting this together. I mean, a lot of goes into getting this to happen. People at Three West seem to have done a very nice job here. And again, to Bob, for instance, my friend who's controlling some of the AV magic behind the scenes. And just a few of my friends at the NYAMP, for instance, Dr. Donnie, who's here, Dr. Peter, Dr. Sean, some of the board of members that I'm part of the board of directors with. I'm just applauding what's going on in the state as we're getting closer to maybe having that vision that I remember as a kid listening to my father at the kitchen table talk about getting a license for naturopaths in New York State. And that would be such a big deal because it's everything in our profession, in licensure in general, stems from New York. Every state says, what did New York do? And so this is such an important thing, and we're getting closer, and it's just a wonderful opportunity, wonderful time to be alive. And tonight's lecture is a little bit of this, a little bit of that. It's really a compendium of some of the things I've been thinking about. It doesn't really have a lot to do with blood type. So I just assume that that's something perhaps maybe we can bring you back and talk about at some later point, or maybe you can buy one of my books or something like that. But it's interesting. It's on a topic that I think is extremely germane. It's right now on the cutting edge of virtually all the conventional medicine interest in the field of cellular dysfunction is centering around some of the processes that I'd like to talk to you about today. And, I mean, the number of citations that are coming up in this field, which is called autophagy or autophagic processes, stem from a kind of a different awareness of what is going on inside the cell than what we've had traditionally. And I think that its very core is a kind of a strategy that a holistically inclined traditional physician could appreciate because it's a cleansing function. And we're very much into cleansing, perhaps maybe on a macroscopic level, but this is cleansing on a microscopic level. And it turns out to be something that has some very significantly simple ways of being able to actually influence for the better. I chose this picture basically because of the interesting dynamic that actually is taking place in the picture. Obviously, it snowed, and the crocuses have continued to thrive. Probably snowed maybe 12 hours or maybe 24 hours ago. And yet the crocuses are thriving very nicely. However, if you took a human being and had them lay out in the snow for 12 to 24 hours, they would not look like that crocus. And that's basically the gist of this lecture. How come human beings don't look as good in the snow as crocuses? And I want to answer that question for you tonight. Let me see if I can get all this to work. Goals. To discuss the significance of autophagy as part of a complex set of glycemic interrelationships. That's goal number one. So to understand what that means is you have to understand everybody is very comfortable talking about genomics and the genome. Glycomics is the glycome, whereas the genome is the sum total of all the proteins and genes that make a person up. The glycome is the sum total of all the carbohydrates that make a person up. All the glycoconjugates and glycans. And it turns out that actually, even though when you take biochemistry in high school, they talk about carbohydrates as part of energy production, so you might learn the citric acid cycle, or you might learn something having to do with glycolysis. It turns out that about 12% of the carbohydrates are not involved in energy production. They're part of the physical makeup of who we are. And that is a significant amount, and it turns out to exert a tremendous amount of influence on the day-to-day events that govern how we function in terms of information. So when we talk about the glycome, we're talking about the sum total of all the carbohydrates and sugars in the body that don't do something besides wind up on a jelly donut. So jelly donut is the carbohydrates we eat. These are the carbohydrates that are part of who we are. To show you a cool tool that I've been developing, which actually is part of the Center of Excellence program and project that I'm doing, that sort of tries to become fluent in trying to address what it means to actually use what we call in our naturopathic field the vis. The vis is this metaphorical greater than. It's the thing that gets people better despite the doctor. It's the thing that makes wounds heal. It takes us as a piece of machinery that fixes ourselves. It's what you could call the innate wisdom of the body. You could call it basically all the capacities to rejuvenate and regenerate are part of the vis. And for many, many decades in our profession, the vis was an allegorical thing. We talked about it. We knew it was there. If you were a sophisticated enough physician, you kind of tried to work with what you thought it was. But there was no way of quantifying it. There was no way of understanding, perhaps, maybe, is the vis itself so completely ethereal that we'll never understand it? Or is it actually quantifiable as actually a series of very simple things that are acting in a complex manner? And if so, we've got tools to look at that. Believe it or not, there are mathematical and computational tools that allow you to look at this electron cloud of what is known in this field as emergence. Emergence is a powerful word. It is how things assume a significance upon a change in scale that is not anticipated by understanding the previous scale. Complicated, yes, but simple fact. Molecules of water exist. If you have enough molecules of water, the water has a temperature. So temperature is an emergent quality of water. Water molecules don't have a temperature, but a glass of water has a temperature. So when we see that things emerge, they come from a series of interactions that come from the elemental actions of things that are simpler, but produce an effect that is not anticipatable or predictable or understandable by just studying the things that make it up. And here is the crisis in modern medicine, because modern medicine is reductionist. Modern medicine breaks everything down into a linear cause and effect relationship to the point where everything gets broken down into its most simple, reduced form. It's yielded a tremendous amount of benefit over the years. Drugs, understanding of physiology, understanding of immunology. It's wonderful to break things down to understand their core attributes. But guess what you lose when you do that? You lose life. Because life doesn't exist as those core things get broken down into this irreducible form. Like one author said, take something and put it in the blender. He says, after you push the button, if you're still as interested in it afterwards as you were before you pushed the button, you're a reductionist. I mean, just hypothetically, take a frog. I mean, don't do this. But put it in a blender. If at the end of it all, that particular collection of red pulpy stuff is what you're interested in, you're a reductionist. If you're interested in frogs, you're not going to be a reductionist and you're not going to see a frog in the blender. You're going to see a frog before you push the button. You're not going to see a frog after you push the button. So part of what we're talking about here is this knowledge that these carbohydrates, the glycome, acts in such a way as to make these biological networks much smarter. So we understand that, you know, genes are like blueprints, right? So I have a gene, it acts upon a protein, the protein winds up doing something, and something happens. So in other words, it's much like a computer program. I've got codons, I've got nucleotides, I've got base pairs. The whole thing comes out as a sort of a nice little blueprint. Wonderful. The difficulty is if you've ever actually sat down with an architect and said, I want to build a house, by the time the contractor's done, your house doesn't look anything like that blueprint. Okay, you've made all sorts of concessions to reality. You sat down with the architect and said, I want a slate roof. I want copper gutters. I want 100% cedar shingles. All right? And the architect writes your house for that. But then you discover that slate roofs are very expensive, so you go for the asphalt. You discover the copper gutters are very expensive, so you go for the aluminum, right? Now, somebody who's reading the blueprint for the house is expecting those other things, but when they look at the house, they didn't get it, okay? Because the blueprint was only the starting point for the transformation. That transformation had a lot of phenotypic plasticity, developmental sort of randomness that takes place, and a lot of the interactions are under the control of the glycome. So, and again, the final thing I want to do is tell you about a glycopharmaceutical. So pardon me if there's 15 minutes of intense whoring at the end of this, so that ultimately I can tell you something that can afford the opportunity to put that meal in front of you. So anyway, here's an interesting anniversary, because it's exactly 20 years to this month that I wrote about the last glycomic nutrient with something called arabinogalactan, which is now known as larch, larix, ara-6. I wrote about that 20 years ago to this day. It was the first time that that had been put into circulation. And I could tell you some interesting stories of how that wound up on my doorstep, literally. And then I wound up researching it based upon some requests on the part of some Japanese people who were making larix as an alternative to gum arabic. They were making this carbohydrate as an alternative way to put glue on the back of envelopes. And they thought that maybe it had some immunologic properties because of its molecular weight, and we then took it further in, and it's now something that's in common practice. People use it for ear infections and all sorts of things. But I'm not talking about that today either. I'm talking about something else. I want to just give you some grounding in this whole thing. What we're talking about a lot of the time is something called aberrant glycosylation. Now, glycosylation is really the process, and let me see if I've got this thing turned on. Okay. Aberrant glycosylation, you see, as you probably remember from biochemistry, you glycosylate by slapping carbohydrates on things like fats and things like proteins, right? So hormones get carbohydrates put on them, lipids get carbohydrates put on them, ceramides, glycosphingolipids, glycoproteins, most of the receptors in your body are glycosylated. So the aberrant nature just means that you glycosylated in some screwed up manner, okay? You put the wrong sugar in the wrong place, maybe you put the wrong a monosaccharide at the end of your polysaccharide, maybe it's in the wrong three-dimensional position, it's in the wrong alpha-1-6 versus beta-1-3. So sometimes it could be as subtle as actually just being in the wrong place in space. But what you did is you made an aberrant glycosylation product, okay? So something in your metabolism produced a screwed-up carbohydrate on some protein someplace. This happens a lot because glycosylation is not very tightly controlled. It isn't as tightly controlled, for instance, as translation or transcription. You can make a lot of errors when you glycosylate proteins. You don't make too many errors when you translate from the gene. Things that cause aberrant glycosylation, for instance, are things like these. Animal species glycosylate differently. Different blood groups glycosylate differently. As you get older, you mess up your glycosylations. Why do we run glycosylated hemoglobins on people? Because their glycosylation is screwing up as part of the diabetic process. Site in the intestines. If you've got inflammatory bowel disease, you're glycosylating in your intestinal tract different. If you have a certain type of poor diet, you make aberrant glycosylation. If you have pathology, like inflammatory bowel disease or bacterial overgrowth, you glycosylate aberrantly. Differentiation in tumors and maturation as part of the oncology process, all aberrant glycosylation, and bacterial status. If you have a lot of bacterial overgrowth or all sorts of infectious states, you make screwed up carbohydrates on proteins. So aberrant glycosylation is a common thing. You can see, as with most of this, this will run through the thread of just about everything that gets somebody sick in this world. Okay? So there's two types. Pardon me if this is a basic lesson in biochemistry that you should have paid more attention to when you were at Bastyr and National College, and now you're going to pay the price. Okay, because now this is going to be onerous for the next 20 minutes. But basically, the bottom line is I'm trying to do it with little pretty diagrams to sort of get around the fact that this is all relatively part and parcel of your life. If you deal with sickness, you're dealing with phenotypic manifestations of this. So aberrant glycosylation, there's two types of glycosylation, what's called N-linked and what's called O-linked. Okay? N-linked I call hard glycosylation because this is normally glycans you're slapping on proteins. So the proteins are hard and you're putting sugars on. And typically, this takes place a lot in the endoplasmic reticulum, in the Golgi, the receptor glycosylation, a lot of things like epidermal growth factor, transforming factor beta, almost all the tumor necrosis factor. The factors are not glycosylated, but the receptors are very highly glycosylated. And you can imagine the difference between being not glycosylated and glycosylated is what pulls them together. Because the amazing thing about proteins and carbohydrates and proteins and glycans, they love each other. Okay? That's why if you want to have a truly long afternoon, study the synthesis of amino sugars. And you see that every nucleotide is bonding to some glycan. So you've got UDP glucose, UDP mannose, GDP mannose. I saw a sugar called gulose, UDP gulose. What an ugly name for a sugar. But the end result is that you have the N-linked, and this takes place in the endoplasmic reticulum. So as your little genome is making that wonderful protein that's going to be something really nice, it goes into the endoplasmic reticulum, and the endoplasmic reticulum is sort of like finishing school. So it's like My Fair Lady with Rex Harrison. Rex Harrison takes the protein, and it starts to put little carbohydrates on it as part of a finishing element. And the carbohydrates act as tags. So if you slap a fucose on this protein, it goes to the thymus. But if you put a mannose on the protein, it goes to the liver. So for instance, by slapping all these carbohydrates, you're kind of finishing up the protein and getting it to fold a certain way. And so that's called protein tagging. O-linked glycosylation is basically booger glycosylation. Anytime you blow your nose, anything like that, you're making something called mucus. And mucus comes from something called mucins. And mucins are critical to soft glycosylation. So they're part of our barrier defenses. These are the high molecular weight polysaccharides that oftentimes the body will stick a residue called sialic acid or a neuraminic acid. And that gives the carbohydrate a negative charge, so it shoots out into space. Like when you go to the science center and you put your hand on the ball and the hair on your arm sticks out. So negative charge takes these carbohydrates and shoots them out into space. And that's making the intestinal tract protected. So these mucins are very negatively charged and they extend out into space as a way of sort of acting as antennas, acting as a sort of a type of insulation, and acting as, believe it or not, growth media for bacteria, conditioning the growth of bacteria, doing all sorts of things, breaking up eventually and getting converted by the bacteria into short-chain fatty acids, a function determined by your blood type, I might add. So many of the what you call tumor markers are O-linked glycosylation products. So most of the onco markers, CA15-3, CA29, 19-9, 2729, CEA, are all O-linked glycosylation products. And aberrant glycosylation turns what might have been a self-respecting O-linked mucin with your blood type into a tumor marker. So an aberrant O-linked glycosylation product is probably a tumor marker at some point. So now, having done that, I just want to go back and look, take a little bit at the N-linked part for now. So now we're just talking about the N-linked. So here's our aberrant glycosylation. Here's our N-linked. And here's how N-linked glycosylation expresses itself in the body. Here's the word of the day. Ubiquitination. Okay? The process of slapping ubiquitin on things. Now, what does ubiquitin do? Does anybody remember this? Well, ubiquitin is to the process of putting ubiquitin molecules on proteins as a way of tagging them for destruction or removal, or sometimes they actually get ubiquinolated as a way of essentially being sent around to do repair on DNA, believe it or not. Ubiquitination is actually not necessarily all garbage removal, but it's actually tagging the protein residues. And this is largely leftover stuff. It gets tagged and basically gets sent to various places. And what happens is the protein gets a ubiquitin tag, and ubiquitin basically has all these lysine residues. And so ubiquitin actually attracts more ubiquitin that bonds to the lysine and makes these feather-like projections, and depending upon how that ubiquitin is made, determines the fate of the protein. So oftentimes, the most common effect of ubiquitination is to cause the decay of transcription factors. So for instance, nuclear factor kappa beta is a transcription factor that controls a lot of pro-inflammatory genes. The thing that controls nuclear factor kappa beta is after a while it gets ubiquitinated and ultimately winds up getting tagged for destruction. Now, what does that tell you about ubiquitination? You'll see later on it's an epigenetic function, because in order to qualify for epigenetics, you have to control gene expression someplace other than the genome. And by controlling transcription factors in terms of their half-life, you're exerting an epigenetic effect on that thing, just as if it was a histone or if it was a methylation pattern. So, then we have apoptosis. A lot of the things that tell cells to kill themselves occur through the glycosylation inside the Golgi or the endoplasmic reticulum. All the caspases, all the death enzymes that are a result of all the apoptosis genes like BAX and BCL, they represent activation that results from N-link glycosylation. Receptor agonism is just a fancy word that says that sometimes receptors can get clogged up by aberrant sugars just as much as anything else. So for instance, if I considered a receptor, let's say a piece of scotch tape, and I went to an ashtray, and I put the scotch tape in the ashtray, I would have made a very ineffectual piece of scotch tape at that point, because I would have flooded all the receptors of the scotch tape with the cigarette ash, and I wouldn't be able to hold much together because it lost its adhesive properties. So receptor agonism is a big deal because it basically is behind most of the metabolic disturbances, type 2 diabetes, any sort of lack of estrogen sensitivity, any lack of receptivity to any of the adrenal hormones, hypothalamic releasing factors, pituitary. Anytime you lose exquisite sensitivity to hormonal stimulation, it's almost always the result of receptor agonism, and receptor agonism is almost always the result of having glycosylated the receptor with some sugar that didn't belong there. Okay? ER stress does not what the name implies. It might imply to you that some guy in an emergency room is getting very stressed out, but it isn't that at all. It stands for endoplasmic reticulum stress. Okay? What is it when you walk around with a rock in your shoe? You don't walk much like a guy who doesn't have a rock in his shoe. Okay? So you can always tell the guy with the rock in his shoe from the guy without the rock in his shoe. Endoplasmic reticulum stress is when your endoplasmic reticulum has a rock in its shoe. That rock in its shoe is most always some improperly folded protein that didn't fold properly because the actual glycans were aberrantly glycosylated, so the protein got all twisted up. And in, like a rock in the shoe, it activates a primitive response called endoplasmic reticulum stress, and that causes a whole series of events to occur that oftentimes result in the damage or death of the cell. So, take-home message about endoplasmic reticulum stress is if your client is taking steroids, he's got endoplasmic reticulum stress, because steroids are singularly able to relieve endoplasmic reticulum stress, much like telling a guy with a rock in his shoe that he doesn't have a rock in his shoe. Okay? You do nothing to remove the endoplasmic reticulum stress with steroids. You just block the reaction to it. So the same stresses that are in the endoplasmic reticulum are still there. You just basically have essentially blunted the normal reaction to it. So if a person's taking steroids, they've got endoplasmic reticulum stress. So that leaves us with autophagy, which is the topic here. So what is autophagy? A type of housekeeping. Okay, so what that is type of cellular cleansing. And that comes as a side effect of the ubiquination process and also by the activation of certain types of master metabolic switches, as we'll get to in a second. You guys with me? Good. So far, so good. I'm glad. You got any questions, you know, just chime in. So we're back here. I've added a few more little balls to the diagram. All right? Autophagy, ER stress. ER stress leads to something called the unfolded protein response. The unfolded protein response is really what I just described. You don't like unfolded proteins or misfolded proteins in your endoplasmic reticulum, just like you don't like rocks in your shoes. All right? The unfolded protein response oftentimes induces autophagic response. So when the cell has come to the conclusion that there's just a bunch of misfolded proteins inside of me, the thing it tries to do is activate the cleansing mechanism. Okay? The other thing that comes from endoplasmic reticulum stress is something called the heat shock response. And this is known as the activation of what are known as heat shock proteins, the most famous ones being 12, 72, and 90. Okay? Heat shock proteins are just what the name says. If you have a yolk, let's say I'm sitting at the kitchen table, and I crack an egg, and I put it into a skillet. What is happening is a massive heat shock response, okay? I'm calling it an omelet, but what you're looking at are proteins that are getting highly denatured by heat. Heat and proteins don't like each other. Glycans and proteins like each other. Heat and proteins, they don't like each other. So what happens is if you get a reasonable amount of heat, you activate these what are called chaperones, molecular chaperones, that come out and start to retwiddle the protein back into its proper shape. These are called heat shock proteins. And the interesting thing about them is that they're inducible by a variety of cellular stresses, not just heat. So heat shock proteins are called chaperones. They take the protein and they kind of massage it, try to put it back together again, or failing that, they signal the caspase system and upregulate the suicide genes, and the cell just calls it quits and commits hari-kari. So with the heat shock response, I either fix the problem or I actually just call it quits and just do the sempaku with the sword, pull my intestines out, I look at them as I die. So the other side of the coin is that you wind up here as this relating to this, as you'll see as part of the lecture. But here's an amazing thing that doesn't get enough play in the rest of this lecture, but I'm going to leave this with you. Heat shock protein number 90 is known as a phenotypic canalizer and canalization. To understand what that means is you have to understand the basis of epigenetics. Epigenetics, you start out with the blueprint. Then by the time Joe Epigenetics is done with you, you have the vinyl siding and the AstroTurf and all the other things you didn't want, okay? That's epigenetics. Heat shock proteins actually, believe it or not, contain a snapshot of the phenotype before the epigenetic influences. So it's like the auto-restore on your computer. Okay, when you make a tremendous big mistake, you go in there and you do auto restore. It turns out that heat shock proteins have in them a molecular basis to the chaperoning system that they contain the original canalization of many of the pre-epigenetic instructions. So one of the things I think you do when you put a person inside of an infrared sauna is you're actually epigenetically engineering that person by inducing the heat shock response, okay? So one of the things that comes out of the whole infrared thing is that it actually, as we now know, has a big influence on heat shock proteins and also a big influence on what's called hormesis, which is this idea that you can induce a response with a small stimulus and then harvest the extra response as a therapeutically potential thing. In other words, like Nietzsche said, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. It's the same way with these kind of things as well. If I give a small amount of heat, I generate such an overreaction on the part of the heat shock proteins that not only do they fix the bent protein I'm interested in, they just start fixing other stuff as well. Just a little review here in terms of how proteins fall. normally you wind up with the stuff coming down the genome. It's a sequence of amino acids that have basically been generated via the transcription and translation devices. So by the time it gets kicked out of the ribosome, when messenger RNA and transfer RNA is done, it's all dirty work, is you wind up with proteins that come in either two forms, depending upon how they're bent. So you get like an alpha helix or a pleated sheet. And that's the secondary structure because it's still only two-dimensional. Okay? But then what happens is an amazing thing is depending upon how it's glycosylated, the proteins go through almost like an origami thing where they kind of start folding themselves, literally like you had a piece of origami where you take a two-dimensional piece of paper, and yet by the time you're done, you've got a duck, you know, or a swan or something, you know? So, and then the last part is where you stick all the glycosylation things, the quaternary structure, and that's where all the information is actually put into the protein. So that if you're looking at this in terms of bit count, this is roughly about 8 bits, this is roughly about 16 bits, and this is roughly about 64 bits. So many much more orders of magnitude, more variability. I'm sure that's something you didn't need, but I wanted to just kind of make sure we understand what protein folding is. Basically taking something from one dimension and turning it into four dimensions, because most of the time a protein doesn't have a purpose until it has a three-dimensional shape, right? Because an enzyme needs a clef to bind stuff. A receptor needs a pocket to bind. There's all dynamics related to it, the actual attractiveness that are related to three-dimensional structure that it doesn't assume until it gets there. So now we're on to the final version of N-glycation, and you can see where this all winds up. ER stress leads to the heat shock protein. The heat shock protein response inhibits the unfolded protein response. It also provides the basis for a hormetic response. And you can see here that basically here the unfolded protein response goes to inflammation and aging. Again, the hormetic response basically blunts that. And receptor agonism goes to metabolic disturbance, as I said before, things like diabetes type 2, Alzheimer's, things like that. All of these things that I just described to you, all because they result in aberrant glycosylation, produce an increased sensitivity to lectins. So this is not a lecture on lectins, but let's just say that lectins are proteins found abundantly in our diet that love to bond, like all proteins, they love to bond to sugars. So lectins are proteins with a sweet tooth. And so you have lectins in soybeans and lectins in peanuts and lectins in peas. And they all have highly specific preferences. The lectin from escargot binds a tumor marker only found in breast cancer cells. The lectin from peas only binds alpha fetoprotein, which is found in liver cancer. The lectin from soybeans bonds certain types of things that are associated with colon cancer. Lectin in peanut binds the TN antigen, which is upregulated in colon cancer. So most of the dietary lectins either bond in ways that are predictable by knowing a person's blood type, or they represent reactions that only take place when the tissue is diseased. And this is the major giveaway about what you can say about some of the blood type stuff, is that it works its best the sicker the person is. Because the sicker the person is, the more deranged their glycosylation is, the more they're going to be sensitive to a diet that plays around with lectins. The more normal you are, the more normally glycosylated you are, the less you need to worry about watching the things like lectins, because you've got capacities to deal with that. So the diet directly correlates in terms of its efficacy with the degree of pathology that you see in the client. The more pathological changes, the more they'll benefit from making those choices on things like lectins and stuff. And this is something I've actually observed, and I just teach it now as axiomatic. Somebody comes in and says, I followed the blood type diet, and it really didn't seem much different. And by the time you do the case history, there's nothing wrong with them. Okay? So, I mean, ultimately, maybe you should worry about something besides your diet. Maybe you should try to get out more or see, you know, meet a girl or something. I know, you know, the other side of the coin is ultimately when somebody comes in and is sick, that's when they want to start thinking about this stuff. Anyway, this is like a Scientific American from about a week ago. And again, it's just that there's a massive amount of interest in autophagy, which is the thing we're spending the majority of our time in. I gave you that whole prodromal thing just to basically ground you in the autophagic part. Pathway to youth. Well, it turns out that actually autophagic processes seem to be associated with the ability to combat aging. Why? Because what is the only thing that seems to have any indication to be able to control aging at all? Starving yourself. Okay? Calorie restriction has got some good evidence, at least if you're a worm, that it could lengthen your life. Okay? But the other side of the coin is that, like the poet said, you know, you can create a life that's so miserable that it just simply appears longer. So the other side, to be able to give people, put them on calorie restriction, you can't do, it's not going to be an epidemiologically rational approach. Because people like to eat, okay? Eating is a social environment. Eating does a lot of things for people that makes them very happy. It also drives the economy, puts people in restaurants. So to just convert the entire population to a CR type of intervention, especially on the fact that the information is not completely conclusive at this point, is not necessarily the case. But there are other things. For instance, here's something that Maura sent me from the New York Times. That turns out that exercise increases autophagy. It turns out that exercise is a well-known hormetic stimulus as well, right? What do you do when you exercise to get muscle? You destroy a small amount of muscle, and then you make more muscle in response to the muscle you just destroyed. So, again, we're starting to see that many of the benefits of this kind of interaction are the traditional things that we associate with being healthy, controlling your intake of nutrients, exercising, are the result of the actual optimization of the autophagic process. And so to get right back to that, we have to talk about one guy in particular, and that's Mr. mTOR. Okay, Mr. mTOR is the major gene behind all of the autophagic processes. So if you do anything related to autophagy, everybody talks about mTOR. It's a nice thing about that. It's like if you want to just have one thing to discuss about this entire molecular biology, this whole thing, it's mTOR. And that mTOR just stands for mechanistic target of rapamycin, which is, of course, how geneticists give people names to things. But it's also sometimes you see it as a mammalian target of rapamycin. So what it's describing is it's saying, this gene we discovered was inhibited by giving people this drug. So we're so imaginative that we decided to name the gene after the drug that we discovered inhibited the gene. So it got this name. But mTOR is kind of a cool name, I think. And so you see also other types of genes, to a lesser degree, Beclin-1 and FOXO1. This is called a forkhead transcription factor, and Beclin-1 is just a series of things that control master metabolic programs and things. But the guy to know, the one person, the 800-pound gorilla in the room when it comes to autophagy, is mTOR. So to go a step forward, let's talk about Mr. mTOR. I'm sorry if this doesn't look so great back there. And I tried to scan it at the highest possible resolution. So here's like a split, all right? Condition, abundant resources. So in other words, here you are, eating to your heart's desire. High calories, all sorts of things. It turns out that those nutrients stimulate insulin and other growth factors, and that stimulates Mr. mTOR. And then Mr. mTOR basically starts to send signals out that cause proteins and fats to be synthesized to grow and proliferate, that wouldn't be so bad. But he has this other nasty habit, is that in a situation of nutrient excess, he inhibits autophagy. So in other words, the more you eat, the less you clean your cells, the less you scarf up things. Okay? So that is the problem, because what happens is you start having a buildup of junk inside the cell that is not getting gotten rid of. And so you get the unfolded protein response, you get the prions in dementia, you get all the oncoantigens and stuff like that. So that's what happens when you eat too much and activate mTOR, is you actually wind up being able to inhibit the autophagy process. Now, what is autophagy? I'll give you a simple example. I own a factory. I make replacement windows. I have a wonderful staff, but however, I just replaced somebody and they ordered too much glass, and now I have more glass than I need, and they ordered not enough of the hardware, and they ordered too much of the vinyl, and so I have more pieces than I can make whole things out of. Okay? I also get a new staff in there, and so they don't know what they're doing, so the first windows that they make are all screwed up and I can't sell them. Okay? So what do? I put them off in the parking lot. So my parking lot looks like a whole bunch of nasty-looking windows I can't sell and leftover parts that I don't have enough pieces to make the whole thing. Okay? That's this. Okay? Normally, you'd have these things would get phagocytized and get taken apart. Strangely enough, you'll see what happens here. If you cut down on resources, scarce resources, growth factor production declines, mTOR is inhibited. It turns out that when mTOR is inhibited, autophagy ramps up. And so the cell growth and proliferation stops, but the cell starts cleaning itself. Okay, and the result is growth slows and adequate resources. It will stay that way until you over-neutrophy again. So what's interesting is not only are these things phagocytized and kicked out of the cell, but most of the time the cell will actually eat these things as energy because they're chunks of protein. Okay? So they'll get disassembled and they'll be actually thrown into the gluconeogenesis pathways. So it's not just a simple matter of actually getting rid of something. It's oftentimes that if you're starving enough, that's going to be the first stuff you eat. Okay? So if I take a person and actually put them in a, I don't know, some starvation type thing, concentration camp or something, they're going to get autophagic to the point where they're going to actually start taking the autophagic stuff and converting it into energy resources. Okay? Now, at a certain point, that doesn't happen, and you then start to actually start getting rid of this stuff. But this obviously looks suspiciously like calorie restriction. So let's take this a step further. mTOR activity continues. So now, again, certain cells proliferate too much and become senescent. Many accumulate abnormal proteins and malfunction in other ways. So too much food, too many growth factors, too many cells proliferating, too much damage in the cells, and too much proliferation of damaged cells, too much junk in the trunk, not getting rid of, and now you wind up with age-associated diseases. Okay? So now, let's go to the condition. This is the other thing. Now, instead of starving a person, what if we gave them things that inhibited mTOR? Now, of course, they didn't name the drug mTOR for nothing, so the first thing they discovered was like, we can use this drug called rapamycin, which is a really ineffectual antibiotic, but it has one thing in common. It blocks mTOR. So they find, for instance, that other things do that as well. Calorie restriction, metformin, right? And a lot of natural products block mTOR too. The autophagy increases, the cells in senescence is reduced, the intercellular inclusions, aging slows, tissues stay healthy longer. Now I just want to take a moment and kind of digress a little bit, but it actually has to do with using a tool that I've developed that actually does things that play into this whole lecture. And it's a program called DataPunk. And DataPunk I wrote because I wanted to develop ways of being able to provide a network analysis in these biomedical, biochemical processes that used the conditions of what is known as graph theory. Okay, graph theory is basically the mathematical analysis of networks. And so it comes back from the mathematician Euler, who was able to answer a question about whether or not you could cross five bridges in the city of Königsberg and wind up on a certain island without ever using the same bridge twice. And actually, Euler said you couldn't, but that was the beginning of graph theory. And so now you've got people like, who's this guy with Facebook, Mark Zuckerberg? Well, Mark Zuckerberg owes an awful lot to Euler, as does the guys at Google, because almost everything that's done in the realm of network analysis that has anything to do with social networks or anything uses these very same algorithms. So I thought it was interesting to take molecular pathways and use the tools of network analysis that normally would be deciding whether or not you should get an ad for, you know, I don't know, some ridiculous thing that Facebook gives you or something like that. But it turns out that if you look at Google, they often do give you fairly sophisticated targeted ads. So for instance, that whole mechanism is part of graph theory, and graph theory is how networks and pathways come alive. So anyway, DataPunk was constructed with the notion of networking the VEAST. The VEAST was the thing I talked to you about 9 hours ago that actually was the idea of this ephemeral quality that life emerges from simple things acting in complex manners. It's why your boo-boos get better. It's why things happen that we can't figure out. It's why us doctors who are naturopathically inclined don't want to get too interventive, want to be more assistive, right? So anyway, the visa is a big deal when it comes to networks. Well, there's other biochemical pathways out there. You can find, for instance, Reactome is one from the government. KEG is one from Kyoto Encyclopedia of Genes and Genomics from Japan. Antares Gene from NCBI. The difference between those and my networks is that mine think, okay, and theirs are dumb. So when you go to their networks and you click on something, you're lucky if you get a hyperlink to an article about the thing you clicked on. But you see, when my networks, if you put them together, they rebuild themselves, reanalyze themselves, and give you an analysis based on things. So you can mix it. If I wanted to take autophagy and apoptosis and mTOR and acute myelogenous leukemia, put them into the same network, I can hit a number and the network would regenerate. Okay, and it would come up with that information. So before I show you any of that, I just want to bring you to the basic concept of information technology, because this is critical. Information technology is based upon the premise of three things, or four things, that most everything in this world is noise until it turns into data. And data is just the thing itself. It's stuff that has no value, okay? It's just numbers. If I said to you 13, 46, 42, 10,012, A, B, X minus 4, okay? I don't know what those things mean. It's data, okay? By the time you start to impart meaning to data, you get information. So information is resolving a degree of uncertainty about the nature of the data, typically by an understanding of what it means to measure something. Stimulus leads to knowledge. Knowledge is the incorporation of what they call the reporter's questions: who, what, where, why. Okay? So when I take information and I ask the reporter questions, I get answers, I get knowledge. And finally, knowledge, if it leads to an emergent appreciation for the significance on a wider scale, goes to wisdom. So the difference between someone who just got out of a naturopathic college 6 hours ago and John Bastier is here and here. Okay? And his knowledge came not as a result of anything I did. It was the result of 30 years of doing things in some way that he was able to contextualize. And it produced a walkable version of wisdom. And that walkable version of wisdom was a phenomenally appreciable quality. Wise people are not hard to find, and they're not hard to identify. Okay? Wise physicians are extraordinarily valuable. See, if I can take a student and make them wise, instead of waiting for them to make themselves wise in 30 years, I have a person who can combat the market forces that are leading to our professional extinction. Okay? Those market forces are the following. To all the MDs in this audience, my apologies, I'm not talking about you. I like you. You're here. You're one of us. However, one of the things that occurs in this world, as evidenced by this IHS, is that you have a lot of people who have MDs after their name who think they know a lot of things about nature, and they don't. And they've convinced themselves that because they ran courses and taught each other things back and forth, and so they now think they're something called integrative. The integrative word is interesting, but it's not particularly useful, and it doesn't have scientific significance. Okay? The only problem is that these integrative physicians are covered by Big Brother. Okay? So one of the nice things about Big Brother is Big Brother obfuscates the responsibility to pay for your own health care, so everybody thinks they're going to see those people for free. But the reality is they're getting screwed someplace else. We all know that. The other side of the coin is Joe in the health food store. Anybody from a health food store here? Don't take this offense. You're one of us. But the other side of the coin is that the guy in the health food store, he's going to do some stuff. He's going to do it for free. So you got integrative MD guy who's doing it with Big Brother paying the bill, and you got the guy in the health food store with Joe Pizzorno's textbook who's doing it for free. Okay? How are you going to be a workable argument in favor of what it is you just spent $250,000 on to get this education and make some kind of a running chance at succeeding at this? You must be able to produce this. Okay? If you do that, you have a chance of surviving because people will pay for this. Okay? Because it's priceless. Nobody ever wants... I actually remember John Bastier. I was in the first graduating class of Bastier. When I say Bastier said this, or this was at Bastier, I'm talking about the guy. I'm not talking about the school. Okay? He walked around kind of like this, you know, mumbled, all sorts of other things. But you knew inside that man there was wisdom. Okay? And you knew that you were lucky to be in his presence if you were a patient because you knew something important was going to happen. Hopefully to you. Okay? So that is something that hopefully makes a difference in our profession, is if we can take this vice and quantify it and contextualize it and process it and metaphorize it, we can produce wisdom. If we can produce wisdom, we will have a superior technology. If we have a superior technology, you will not be able to ape this. Okay? You can't parrot this. This is the real stuff. Not only that, you're back to the core reason of why we wanted to do this in the first place, I think, which is that you want to use the safest things in the most intelligent manner, in the most interwoven manner, to produce the deepest effect with the least chance of side effects and the least long-term damage. So these are the things that really represent the core value of what we should stand for. And you only get there by developing knowledge in a way that represents its contextualization. So I am not here to teach you how to use my prose. Okay? But this is an interesting thing. Pretty, don't you think? I think it's very beautiful because it turns out that you are looking at mTOR in terms of its signaling thing. For those of you all the way in the back, mTOR is right about there. Now, I said before that my networks think. They think about themselves. This is represented by the changes in colors here. You see these nice, beautiful yellow things? Those are nodes in the network. A node is just a thing, okay? It's like a train stop, station. So these are called edges. These are the lines or the tracks, and these are the stations. So a node in the network that's highly significant gets more and more yellow. So if you want to know where to stomp on this to get the maximum effect, the network is telling you, guess what? All those guys who pay attention to mTOR, they're not kidding. Look, it's definitely very centrally located. Now, networks have what's called between the centrality, and they have something called page rank. They have something called adjacencies. These are all the terms of graph theory that actually talk about how to make a decision about how important something is in the flow of things. And it turns out that those things, no one would ask any rightful person to calculate those. That's why they make computers. And I write software like this. So anyway, what you're looking at here is the network. Now, this is part of the DataPunk program. Let me tell you some cool things about this. You see those green things there?
Yeah.
If you click on that, it would say that there are 7 natural products associated with the expression of this gene. So if you click there, it takes you to a thing that gives you the literature on the 7 products that are associated with it. Okay? If you click on a particular thing, it opens up a huge universe of information on that from a variety of different databases that you do. I do what's called mashups. I take data from this database and combine it with that database and da-da-da-da-da, and you end up with this wonderful insight. I bring this to you only because I want you to understand 2 concepts in graph theory that are important. One of them is called between the centrality. That's just simply how much in the middle something is. And another thing is called page rank. Okay, so things can be important in a network either because they're centrally located or they have something called PageRank. PageRank, I always thought, came from the Google page ranking system. It turns out it was named after Larry Page, who was one of the guys at Google who actually stole this algorithm from Stanford University and then made Google extraordinarily wealthy. And it turns out to be the simplest thing. You can always understand networks if you think in terms of people. Okay? PageRank is a very interesting thing, especially if you're old enough, like me, to remember going to a singles bar. Okay? Back then, you would go to a singles bar, and let's say you were a reasonably attractive person. And you were maybe the most attractive person in the room. So you wind up doing well at the singles bar. So if I compared the fact that you maybe got 10 phone numbers to the average in the bar of people who got 2 phone numbers, you clearly were the number one person in the singles bar when it came to getting phone numbers. So you're clearly the major node. the brilliance of Google and the brilliance of Larry Page is he decided there was something even more interesting to look at the friend of the best-looking person who walked in the bar. Because the person who's friends with the best-looking person may be one of the least likely people to get friends, but they do well because they hang out with the guy who's the best person. So if you look at the person who's the friend of the most popular person, he may have an average of 5 telephone numbers, even though if he was by himself, he might not get 1. So PageRank is not what you know, it's who you know. So ultimately, PageRank also determines a lot of these functions, because we're interested not just simply in what's the center, we want to know who his friends are and are they significant. Well, that little thing made Google, Google. Because up until then, if you actually did anything on the internet would just crank out all sorts of useless stuff. If you went to Excite or you went to some of these other search engines, Google was the first person who said, the quality of your links determines your place. So that if you've got Joe Magumba, CNN is linking to you, your website, boom, you go right up in the rankings. Right? So it's that in a network is a very powerful thing. That is a little bit of the beast right there, PageRank. Again, this is autophagy. So now to just continue to take it, this is not, I have no intention of grokking through this. That's not the point. It's just, if you guys ever look at like Jackson Pollock or something like that? Yeah. Okay, you want to look at these like Jackson Pollock. You don't want to necessarily look at the thing. You want to look at all the splashes and just kind of let you know how the splashes make you feel. So anyway, here's mTOR here. Okay, and once all the things having to do with calories and growth factors activate mTOR, he goes nuts and starts activating all these other things that produce, amongst other things, all changes, eventually vacuoles and things, and then eventually you start going into this autophagic thing. So you can see, not only is mTOR critical in terms of the pathway of mTOR, but you can only get to autophagic responses typically from mTOR itself. This guy, AMPK, is a very significant gene as well, a master metabolic switch. And these two guys always go together. This thing is basically the target of things like metformin. You see this a lot in disorders like diabetes and all sorts of other things having to do with metabolism. Just to show you, if you were to click on any one of these nodes, so for instance, if let's say I moved my mouse here and clicked on that, it would open up a whole instructional window and telling you what the greatness of this particular gene. And then if you click on the herbal thing here, it would tell you all the various herbs that have been associated and their references in the literature. So ultimately here you can see, well, mTOR. I got a kick out of this. One of the things that's really strongly associated with mTOR is cinnamon. Now, how many people take cinnamon for things like diabetes and stuff, right? So again, omega fatty acids, quercetin, resveratrol, all these kind of things. And then eventually we'll get to something that I wanted to talk about. And then the last thing here is you can click on this thing at a certain point and run analytics, which are all those things I was telling you about. And this is a heat map. So for instance, this is looking at all those nodes and giving them a heat value in terms of things of how they show up in the network. So you can imagine if you go into this network and know exactly where to go, know exactly how to manipulate it, know exactly what the interventions are, we can begin to develop next level of being able to do the analysis where the network is now simply putting things together in a contextual relationship and getting closer to not telling you how to practice medicine, but giving you the full array of knowable options. Okay, and then this is, again, the network analytics. For instance, you can see here that mTOR is very highly centrally located, and its page rank is 38, which is very high. So in other words, not only is it high, but he's not only number one with a bullet, but he's friends with like number two, number three, and number four, so they make him look good. This is a guy who, this reminds me of like when you have a bunch of rich high school girls who all show up at the same time, and basically they all look good, they all got money, they're all increasing each other's page rank, you know, so... So, just so some things to think about. Things that influence mTOR that are dependent on mTOR. We know these things. I spoke a bit about them. Exercise, calorie restriction, oleanoic acid from the Phytolacca Sigeum. Sigeum is an old naturopathic treatment for diabetes. Phytolacca, here's an interesting thing. You guys are probably way too old to remember this, but Burki and Toffel, I don't even know if they're in business anymore, which was a great thing. Back when homeopathy was dying, I ran my father's dispensary. So I would have to call up, and normally, in a normal world, you call up a company and they tell you about their new products. In the 1970s, you called up Burki and Toffel and they told you all the things they weren't making anymore. So, we're not making this, we're not making that, we're not making this. But the funny part is in addition to everything else, you had to talk to a woman who had an electrolarynx. So, the entire phone call was this very surreal, like talking to electric shaver, who was telling you all the products they weren't going to be making anymore. But the interesting thing was that they used to make a product for obesity that was an extract from Phytolacca berries. Okay? And it worked. That actually Phytolacca berries are the highest association, they have the highest concentration of this oleanic acid. So interesting, another verification of what people like Burke and the old naturopaths were doing. Be interesting to see if we can get something like that made again. Low leucine diet, omega 3-6, all these things act to control mTOR. Well, we know a lot of these things already. Ketogenic diet, obviously, people have been on ketogenic diets to lose weight since the 50s, all right? Quercetin. Green tea polyphenols, magnolia, which is one of my favorites, spermidine, which is one of the growth factors that actually is a good thing in this case. For instance, spermidine is one of the best dietary sources, if only dietary sources, grapefruit. Well, how many people, when they would want to lose weight just before a wedding, would go on a diet where they ate nothing but grapefruit? Okay? So I find all of this, I love making the kind of, you know, connection stuff. But I'm going to talk to you about something else. I'm going to talk to you about the only thing in this world that's actually mTOR independent, that induces autophagy. Basically, this is called a sugar called triolose. And triolose is an amazing sugar that represents two glucose molecules bonded by a 1,6 alpha glucosidic linkage that's not easily broken. So when somebody goes, wow, two molecules of glucose, that can't be good, okay? Well, it turns out that it's two molecules of glucose that you're probably not going to break up too easily, because one of the interesting things is in order to break it up, you need an enzyme called triolase, and humans don't make a lot of triolase. And it turns out that humans don't make any triolose either. But triolose is why that crocus is okay after 24 hours in the snow, and you're not. Okay? So, why? Because triolose stabilizes most of the cell functions associated with extreme stress. So when you take a small animal, like an invertebrate, like a bug, and freeze them, you thaw them out, they start running again. All right? Same thing with a plant. You try and do that with your kid. That isn't going to happen. Your kid is not going to thaw out if you put him in the freezer for 12 hours. Your frog might. The end result is that the difference between your kid and the crocus and your kid and that frog is the kid doesn't have any triolose, and those things are laced with triolose. Okay? I first heard of triolose plowing through this book. 1,200 pages on the absolutely riveting subject of protein misfolding diseases. You know, I can't tell you. I mean, I had this thing in my bathroom for 2 summers. And every time I had a call from nature, I try and read some of this thing. Well, it turns out in 1,200 pages, it mentioned triolose exactly once. And I was lucky enough to go, that sounds like a sugar, triolose. And I thought to myself, okay, well, let's get started there. So, to give you an idea, remember what I said, proteins love sugars. So in this case, the amino sugar uridine glucose winds up under normal circumstances with glucose producing under the effect of that enzyme triolose 6-phosphate, and under the auspices of this enzyme that gets turned into free triolose. Okay? So it's a relatively simple, straightforward thing. We have lots of this, okay? And we got pretty much this too. But we don't have that and we don't have that. Okay? So that's why if you put your kid in the freezer, ain't going to happen. This is a map to tell you, at least in the amino sugar part, all the things. This happens to be UDP glucose. Again, look at the color. Critically important node involved in tremendous amounts of biochemical reactions having to do with amino sugar metabolism. Nowhere in there will you find in any of those enzymes anything having to do with producing a disaccharide of two glucose molecules linked in an alpha-1-6. It just doesn't occur. Not in humans. Okay? That's the truth. Humans don't make triolose. They barely make triolase. You make some triolase in your kidneys, and you make some triolase in your intestinal tract so that you can break down things that you eat, like mushrooms, that have triolase. Okay? But you don't make a lot of it. So most of the triolose that you consume does not get broken down into the two glucose molecules. It stays as the disaccharide with the unbreakable 1,6 linkage and acts as a type of almost a glucose antifreeze inside the body. But it does more than that. We spend a lot of time looking at cell hydration from bioimpedance analysis, and you find as people get older, the water in their cells changes. You get more water outside your cells than inside your cells, and that's a sign of the breakdown of the cell membrane. Well, when you actually dehydrate a cell of an animal that possesses the ability to make triolose, the cells actually are able to be resistant to dehydration, heat shock, cold, and oxidation, and they do that because it acts to splint the proteins in place. So as the cell dehydrates, the triolose actually splints the proteins in the place that they're supposed to stay, so that when the cell's rehydrated, it's like basically coming back to life. Now you think to yourself, I'm thinking to myself, I should get in the cryogenetics business. As I'm giving this lecture, I'm thinking to myself that Ted Williams' head should be in triolose. Because ultimately right now, if he's not in anything but triolose, when they thaw him out in like 36-25, we don't know what we're going to get. Okay? So the bottom line is maybe we should, you know, think about whether or not we should freeze people in this stuff as well. So anyway, preventing disruptions of this, and anyway, you rehydrate. So the interesting thing is that what it's doing is it's preventing the cell from just about every form of mechanical stress. Thermal stress, dehydration, rehydration, desiccation, all the things that stimulate the heat shock proteins as well. So we're back to those. But there's more to it even with regards to that, because triolose works in tandem with heat shock proteins. Okay? So you wind up that the fact that, remember what I said, heat shock proteins are of a chaperone. They go in there and they massage the cells back. Well, it turns out that triolose is a chaperone on its own. But what do you think happens in animals that can make triolose who activate heat shock proteins? The first thing the heat shock proteins do in those animals is make triolose. Okay? So ultimately, there's this related thing. Remember I talked about that ubiquitination? The idea of tagging cells for destruction, protozoal degradation. Interesting is that everything we normally associate with things like glutathione are strongly associated with the uptake. The more triolose you use to repair stress, the same time you also burning up huge amounts of glutathione at the same time. They should put triolose in little packets and give it to you at McDonald's. Okay? Because this way, they could turn around and say, we didn't give you that prion infection when you ate our hamburger. Turns out that basically one of the things that triolose does apparently is get the cells that are infected by prions to actually phagocytose the prion. And this has been noted for things that have to do with Huntington, alpha-synuclein. This is major accumulated protein in Parkinson's disease. This is, of course, Huntington's chorea. We also know that gamma secretase, tau, all the misfolded proteins associated with neurodegenerative diseases are almost all cleared by administration of triolose. So in other words, the autophagic mechanism is unique for two reasons. Number one, it does a fine job of things in concert with the heat shock proteins, but here's the kicker. It's mTOR independent. That's important because there's one problem with autophagy. If it's mTOR dependent and you inhibit it that way, you might wind up making a cancer cell a little bit more likely to survive. Okay? Now, the jury is out on that because even though there's some evidence that cancer cells in a high autophagic environment become more resistant to chemotherapy, it's inconsistent because it's also been shown that activating tumor suppressor cells increases autophagy. So there's almost two contradictory observations, that activating tumor suppressor cells increases autophagy, and autophagy theoretically can make a cell a little bit more sensitive to perhaps a little bit less sensitive to apoptosis. So having an mTOR-independent initiator of autophagy is highly desirable because you're skipping that entire aspect of things like growth factors and all the other stuff I talked about. So it's a beautiful thing that basically more or less is kind of gets you out of the am I doing something not so good if I've got a cancer patient kind of thing. That's why the independent part is so important. This is in animal models, grant you. This is a Parkinson's disease metabolite, right? Before trehalose, after trehalose. Significant clearance. Anyway, I just wanted to just leave you with that and make you aware that we've had this now. I've used the product. I designed most everything that's available for the company. I really designed because I wanted my private practice. So we've been using it now. Interesting thing I found. The thing that's most pronounced are the people who are messed up neurologically because they're going through some sort of detox. Okay? So the ones who are detoxing from metals, the ones who are detoxing from antibiotic therapy having to do with Lyme's disease, the ones where people are going through some process of detoxification, messing with their heads, this stuff really rocks. Okay? And they will turn around and say, within 2 or 3 days of taking this stuff, I feel like my brain is a lot clearer. Okay? So if you are looking at people with any of the signs of dementia, propensity for any of the degenerative chronic neurological things, think about trehalose. If you're in a position where you're thinking about wanting to do some work with metabolic types of things and approaches, think about trehalose as well. And again, excuse me for my minute of absolute commercial blandishment, it comes in a bottle that looks like that. Here are two places that you can basically find out more information about me, DataPunk, and generativemedicine.org, which is now the center that's in the University of Bridgeport. And I want to leave you with this quote. This is the best quote I've read in 10 years. Okay? It's by a brilliant man named William Winstead. And that ultimately, we don't need to bother to eliminate errors. We should basically recognize and metabolize them. So everything having to do with the process of the vis is through that the nature of recognizing and metabolizing errors. And that's it. Thank you.